Got it? Yep.
So, as I said, first priority queues in general, then the first implementation is based on something called leftist heaps, and the second one is based on brown trees, and brown trees are an interesting data structure in themselves. And next time, I will also discuss binomial heaps. So let's start with priority queues in general. So I assume you've seen them before. Let me just remind you of the essentials. You can think of them as collections of elements together with priorities for those elements. And typical applications are things like Dijkstra's algorithm, where you have the priorities are the distances, and the elements are the nodes, and you have you order them by their distance to the source element. And the operations on a priority queue are, well, you have to start somewhere, then check whether you're empty, and then insert an element in a priority queue, get the element with the minimal priority, and finally delete the element with a minimal priority. You might also combine those two functions that return the minimal element and delete it from the priority queue, but it's slightly simpler to have them as separate functions. And we will not look at priority queues as collections that store pairs of elements and their priorities, but we will just focus on the priorities, so we'll identify the two things, just like we consider sets all the time for the search trees and not maps that map elements to some value. So here it's the same thing. We just focus on one part, namely the important part, the priority. So abstractly, if you just have a collection of priorities, then they are multisets. Why? Because the same priority may occur multiple times in the priority queue. And so it's OK to view it as a multiset of priorities. The elements which are equal to the priorities must be linearly ordered, otherwise it doesn't make sense to ask for a minimal one. And what are the functions now really expressed in Isabel terminology? Apart from the element A, you must provide an implementation type, and then you must provide the following functions: empty, that returns an element of the implementation type; is empty, that checks whether the implementation is empty; insert, that takes an element and a priority queue and returns a priority queue; get min, that from the priority queue returns an element, hopefully minimal one; and delete min, that just removes the element from the priority queue. So those are the functions that we will focus on. So they are just the same ones as here, except there I didn't give the precise type of the functions. I just wrote their effect. So here, these are the types. And we will not focus on all of them, because most of them are trivial. Empty and is empty typically are trivial functions. And so we will focus on those two, insert and del min. Those are the ones where the real work happens, because get min is typically, again, very simple. It's the del min that is the work where you have to do some work. So these are the crucial ones. And those are the ones that we will really look at closely. And frequently, the priority queue has another operation called merge that takes two priority queues and merges them. And once you have that operation, lots of things become simple. Sometimes the priority queue will also provide a decrease key or decrease priority function. That's used, for example, in Dijkstra's algorithm. But it's a little bit tricky in a functional setting. And I may get into it if we have time today, but I don't think I will. So there are some solutions in the literature that are just too complicated, and there is a nice one that I recently worked out with Peter Lammich, but it's not on the slides. I may get to it, but probably not. So if you want to prove correctness of the implementation, as usual, we need an abstraction function, and we will call that mSet for multiset that takes the priority queue and maps it to the set, the multiset of elements in the priority queue. So remember, this is different from a search tree, which implements a set, because sets only contain elements once, so the abstraction function will map it to a set in a priority queue. Elements can occur multiple times. And you need some invariant. So this is the general setup. Of course, you always need an invariant, and for the priority queues, we have decided that the abstract view of a priority queue is a multiset. And what do we need to prove? Under the assumption that the priority queue satisfies the invariant, we need to prove that every operation, every concrete operation, implements its abstract counterpart. So what are these abstract concrete pairs? So the operation empty should implement the empty multiset. Remember, this is our syntax for the empty multiset, and the abstraction function is mSet. So here you express the correspondence of those two, empty and empty multiset. What's the next one? Insert, I guess. No, the is empty. The is empty operation on a multiset should give you the answer whether the abstract multiset is the empty, the abstract priority queue as abstraction is the empty multiset. Insert must be the next one, yes. If you insert an element in the priority queue and you abstract it, that should give you the same multiset as if you abstracted the original priority queue and you add one more element to it. So remember, the plus is the union on multisets, and this is just the syntax for the single multiset with the element x. And get min is supposed to give you the minimal element from the abstract multiset. So if the queue is not the empty queue, so if you abstract the queue and you don't get the empty multiset, then the get min function is well defined, or should be well defined, and you should get the minimal element from the multiset that the queue stands for. So this is a new operation, min mSet, which we haven't seen before and which is only necessary here. Why isn't it just called min, while you have this underscore mSet? Simply because there is already a min operation, but on sets rather than multisets, and to distinguish the two, the one on multisets has this subscript. I guess delmin is the next one, and delmin should correspond to subtraction from multiset. So again, under the same assumption here, if it's not the empty multiset that we are representing, then the delmin operation, if you abstract it, should give you the abstraction of the original Q minus the minimal element, the one that you got out here of get min. So I could just as well write min m set of Q down here, but it was shorter to write this.
And that should be it.
Ah, no, those are the invariants. Of course, the invariants have to be preserved. So again, under that assumption here, you have to prove that the invariant holds for the empty Q. That doesn't have anything to do with this assumption. But these two, of course, under the assumption that Q satisfies the invariant, insert and delete min have to satisfy the invariant as well. So this is just the general specification of multisets given an invariant and an abstraction function. So what the abstraction function is, this M set and this invariant, depends on your concrete implementation, but this is the specification of the interface in terms of the properties that it must satisfy. Now we will look at a very specific implementation of priority queues in terms of a heap. And what is a heap? It's a binary tree where the elements at the root of every sub, the element at the root of any subtree is less or equal to the elements in the subtree itself. So the root is always the minimal element of the whole subtree, but for every subtree, not just for the at the top level. And that, of course, that implementation makes it very easy to get at the minimal element because it's at the root of the tree. And this is the formalization in logic of this heap property, that if you have a node LMR, both subtrees must be heaps, and the elements in the subtrees L and R must be greater or equal than the minimal sub-element M here in the middle. So that's just the same as the text says. And sometimes in the literature, people will use the term heap as synonymous with priority queue. We're not doing that here because it's confusing. A heap is just a special kind of tree, and it can be used as one way of implementing priority queues, but it's not synonymous with priority queue. But yeah, how do we implement a heap with the how do we implement the priority queue with the heap very easily? So the empty priority queue is just the empty heap. Remember, we're now really fixing on binary trees. Is empty is just the test whether we have the empty tree. Get min, if it's a node, then you simply take the element of that node, because by the heap property it must be the minimal element. And let's assume we also have merge now. And how exactly to implement merge, that will come in a moment. Then you can implement the insert operation simply by merging. So if you insert A into a tree T, you simply merge the tree T with the singleton heap that just contains A and nothing else. And merge will do the right thing. If you want to delete the minimal element from a node, well, you simply remove it and you merge what's left over. So all very easy. And all we need to know is how does merge work. And here's a naive implementation of merge. So merge takes two heaps, and depending on what those pairs look like, if one of the two elements of the if one of the two trees is empty, well, you simply return the other tree. But if they're both non-empty, what do we do? This is one way to do it. So you're now in a situation of two trees, the tree one and the tree two, they're both non-empty. Well, first you compare the elements at the root. And of course, the one, the smaller one, has to be the root of the new tree. So let's assume, let's just look at the then branch. If A1 is the smaller one, then you will return a node that has A1 at the root. And A1 was part of T1, so T1 gets destroyed, but T2 is unaffected, so you make T2 the right subtree, and then you merge L1 and R1, because here you have removed from this node, you have removed the element A, moved it up, and now you have to merge L1 and R1 and make that the left subtree. And dually for the if A2 is the small element. So this is one way of doing it. Any problems here? I mean, it works. That's not the question, but. Well, the question is, of course, this doesn't maintain any balance. Because if you look what happens if you were to insert elements in the, if you insert first the bigger elements and then the smaller, so you insert them in decreasing order one by one, then every time, so you have lots of calls. So you have lots of calls of insert, and you insert the smaller and smaller elements. So every time you merge an element A into a tree that contains only bigger elements. So let's see what happens then. So this is the situation we have here. We are we're inserting just the singleton A1, and L1 and R1 are empty. And here this is the big heap that we're inserting into. Okay, so A1 is less than A2 because we assume we're now inserting a smaller element. Okay, so the smaller element becomes the root. We are merging L1 and R1. L1 and R1 are empty trees, so this just becomes the empty tree, and then here we have T2. So every time we simply create one more node on top of the heap, so it just degenerates into a list. It works, but it works in a the complexity that's linear in the size of the tree, which is not very good. So that's why people invented leftist heaps. They're quite an old data structure, and I don't think they're used much in practice. But they it's just an interesting way of balancing this. The merge will follow this idea, but it'll have an additional information, so it will do it more intelligently, and therefore the result will be balanced in some sense. It will be logarithmic. And you can find that in our usual place. And the leftist trees are they have a bit more information in them. They remember the rank in every node. And what is the rank of a tree? It's the depth of the rightmost leaf. So it's simply the length of the right spine, as it's called. So draw a picture. Then this is the rank. And of course, the triangle suggests that they're all at the same level, but that doesn't have to be. It can well be that some of the ones on the left, so the tree could really look like this. And then the rank might well be much smaller than the depth, the height. And then we have the invariant that the rank of every left child is bigger, greater or equal than the rank of the right sibling. So always on the right, it's smaller. The spine on the right is smaller than the rank of the right sibling. Why do we do this? The idea is that we want to, in the end, we want that the rank is logarithmic, and we will only perform the operations along the right spine. So therefore, the operations will be bounded by the logarithmic rank. So the merge will be sent along the right spine. If you merge two heaps, you will descend along their right spine, and therefore the rank of both of them bounds the number of steps. That's a simple observation, simply because you descend only on the right spine. But of course, you have to make sure that the right spine is short enough, is logarithmic in the size, so that you don't get this degenerate situation that I just outlined on the previous slide, where the where your insertion creates a list rather than a nicely balanced tree. And how do we make sure that there's some kind of balance maintained? So in this process of merging, if the rank of a right child gets too large, you simply swap it with the left child. That's the whole idea. And that's why you need this rank information in the trees, so you can quickly check it has the rank through merging, has the rank become on the right become larger than the left rank, then the invariant is no longer maintained. The invariant of every left child is greater than the rank of the right sibling. You simply swap the two and you have the invariant again. And the implementation type is again an ordinary binary tree, except that we have another field here. So we have nodes containing a left and the right subtree and the element, and another field that contains the rank of that node. And we have the usual abbreviations, where the nodes are, in this case, abbreviated by four tuples. And the abstraction function is very simple. It just goes through the tree and collects all the elements here. So if it's the empty tree, you get the empty multi set. And otherwise, if it's a node, you take this element A and take the union with a multiset of the left subtree and the multiset of the right subtree. So now we get to the balancing part. Rank, first we define it simply as a normal function without any care for complexity. So the rank of the empty tree is zero, and the rank, and this is wrong, this R, no, this right, sorry, yeah. The rank of such a node is the rank of the right subtree plus one. So that's the idea of going down the spine to compute the rank. But of course, we hopefully don't have to compute the rank every time because it should be in the tree, but that's just the abstract specification. And if you have such a node, the invariant should guarantee that n is really the rank of the node, the invariant that we haven't stated yet. That's the L-tree invariant that will enforce this. So empty tree is always fine. If you have a tree like this, then n should be the rank of the right subtree plus one, which is the rank of the node itself. And then additionally, the rank of the right subtree should be less than or equal to the rank of the left subtree. That was the balancing invariant. This is simply an invariant that helps you not to recompute the rank every time, but that enforces that this number there is the rank. And then, of course, the two subtrees, L and R, must be leftist trees as well. So this is what L tree stands for, leftist tree. So there are two things. There is the heap invariant, which is about the order, but doesn't care about balancing. And this is the tree invariant, the leftist tree invariant, that cares about balancing, but doesn't care about the order. And then you put them together. The invariant for our leftist heaps is now they must be heaps and they must be leftist trees. And now comes the actual merge function, and the principle is, yeah, you descend on the right. That's what we said. We need to use the fact that the rank is small, if one of the two is empty, then of course you don't have to do much. You just return the other one, and why not? If they're both non-empty, and here I'm introducing a new notation. So this notation here with the equals colon and T1 and equals colon T2 is simply an abbreviation mechanism that says this is merge applied to two non-empty trees, and we call the one on the left T1 and the one on the right T2. It's simply an abbreviation and no language extension per se. And so you again compare A1 and A2 and put if A1 is the smaller one, you put it at the top. So node will create the node, and then you merge R1 and T2. So this is different from what we had before. Compare this with a naive merge. Let's go back. This was the naive merge, where if you merge these two nodes, you would just remove the A1 from the one node, merge the two subtrees, and keep the other node intact. This is here, for example, we would not. So. Let's look at this. So what are we doing here? We are descending along the right subtree. So the recursive call here, we have A1 in the middle, then we put L1, the left subtree that belonged to A1, we put that on the left, and on the right we merge T2, so T2 has not changed. We merge that with R1. So again, we descend on the right of the tree T1. And what does node do? Node doesn't just build a node, it also checks the invariant. So it takes a heap, an element and a heap, and builds a heap. And this is what it does. Okay, so these are the two heaps and the elements. First, you extract the rank out of the left subtree and the rank out of the right subtree. So RK is just a function that extracts that field, the rank field, and returns it. So this is a constant time operation. It doesn't have to compute the rank. And then you check if the rank of the right subtree is less or equal to the rank of the left subtree. Well, then you can just do what the invariant is satisfied. If you have L and R like this, and A in the middle, and the rank of R plus 1. If, on the other hand, if it's the other way around, if the rank of R is bigger than the rank of L, then you put R on the left, L on the right, and then, of course, it's the rank of L plus 1. So this uses the ability in a heap to swap subtrees, because you don't have an ordering on the subtrees, you only have an ordering on the elements in a vertical and not in a horizontal dimension. And so in the horizontal dimension you can commute things, and this is what you're using here in the node construction. And so in both cases, in this case and in the else case, you descend along the right subtree, so your merge here will, one of the two subtrees will not change, but the other one, which you decompose, so here let's look at this, it's at the Venn case, you decompose the first subtree T1, because A1, you extract the A1 from it, and then you merge the right part of it with 2T, T2, and here you merge the right part of the other node with T1. So in both cases, you always trying to go down the smaller tree, or at least the tree with a smaller rank, in order to terminate the search terminate the merge as quickly as possible. This is just one of the lines that we already saw. Question is, why does this terminate? So something terminates, something decreases with every recursive call, but what is it? It's not, if you look at here, merge R1, T2, what happens here is T2 has remained the same, and here you have taken R1. So that's fine, you could say merge, the first argument has decreased. But what has happened here is that the first argument has stayed the same and the second argument has decreased. So what's the abstract justification why this terminates? It's not very difficult, but still you should justify it. Yes?
The size of the two arguments together.
What do you mean by together?
If you add the number of nodes, or the depth of
nodes. No, the size is the right one. I think size must be. I don't think height would do it. If you add them, yes. So it's just size of T1 plus size of T2 that decreases. I think, let me check, does height also? I don't think height decreases, because if you go from one tree into the subtree that has the same height, because the height is the maximum, so one of the subtrees could have the same height. Is that true? Just confusing. No, I think height would work as well. I think, yes, yeah. Height and size would both work. But the standard approach that the Isabel function definition facility takes is that it'll work in terms of size, and it'll first try and do a lexicographic, by default it'll only do a lexicographic ordering, and lexicographically it's one of the two decreases but not both of them, and so you have to instruct Isabel specifically to say please also take sum of sizes into account, and there's a little bit of extra magic that's added in at that point. It's not done by default, because that increases the search space considerably. If you also try sizes, combination of, if you have multiple arguments, and it doesn't happen so often, so it's not the default behavior. Now, the functional correctness proofs are quite straightforward. I don't want to go into them. Let's look at the logarithmic complexity. So first we have a correlation of rank and size that's So this looks reminiscent of something we have for binary trees in general. What is the rule for binary trees in general? Instead of the rank, you have the height. So we know that in any binary tree, 2 to the height of the tree is less or equal number of leaves or number of nodes plus 1 in that tree. And now we want to prove that the same is true for the rank. So we can do two things. We can either prove it directly in the same manner as this is proved, but prove it by induction, prove this very formula by induction on T, and that comes out very easily. But you could also do something else if you know this already. You could prove a relationship between rank and height. And what should that be? If you have a leftist tree, yes, because the rank is just one path along the tree and the height is lots of other paths. So rank T should be less or equal height T. And the law up there should follow from the combination of those two, because the exponentiation is monotone in the second argument, both arguments. And this is a straightforward induction. I mean, both of them are straightforward inductions, but this one is even a bit simpler than the other one because there's no exponentiation here. This is what I would abstractly consider the most slick proof. Concretely, in the implementation that we have, it doesn't quite work as nicely as that. The problem is that we don't have a binary tree, or we don't have the library type of binary trees, but we have this specific type of trees because we also wanted the additional rank field. So we don't have the full library of binary trees. We just have as much as we needed proved for those leftist heaps. And that wasn't one of the things that I had proved, and so it wasn't possible to directly make use of an existing result. And so this is shows you that how important it is to be as generic as possible every time, so that you can reuse libraries. And writing code a second time is usually not much work, but doing proofs a second time is typically more work than you want to invest. And so it's always about sharing not so much the code, but sharing libraries of proofs about the code. And here's an example where, unfortunately, because we used a new data structure, we couldn't share the proofs of the old one. At least not, probably you can with a bit of additional effort. Okay, so now we know that the rank is logarithmic in the size, and now we will look at the complexity of these functions, merge, insert, and delmin, and we will just count the calls of merge, because they all boil down to merge, and merge calls itself recursively. Counting the number of calls of merge is a good measure, and those are the function t, insert, t delmin, t merge. And the first one is that the time for merge is just bounded by the sum of the ranks of the left and the right subtree. And that is not too difficult to see. Why is that? Let's go to the code once more. And here you see, this is the crucial case, of course, the merge of two non-empty nodes. And then here the recursive call, you have you reduced the rank by one because you've gone from T1 to the right subtree, and T2, that rank has stayed unchanged. And here you've reduced the rank of the of T2, and T1 has changed, has stayed unchanged. So you're always removing, you can always remove rank in one of the two ranks until they've both become zero, or until one has become zero, then you're at the end. And this is a straightforward induction on the computation of merge. And then you get this logarithmic corollary. So here the time for merge is bound by the rank. Then we know for leftist trees, the rank is bounded by the logarithm of the size. So then if you put those two together, we get that the time for merge is bounded by the sum of the logarithms of the two arguments, L and R, under the assumption that we have the invariant of being a leftist tree, which we need up here. And then we get this corollary, which looks somewhat nicer. Merge has two arguments, and we need to take the logarithm of both of them. Insert has just one argument, and then it turns out the insert is just the logarithm of the size. The time for insert is just logarithmic in the size of the tree. Plus two, whatever. So how do we get from here to here? You simply look at the definition of insert. So we prove that corollary here. And we look at the case, of course, for insert, if it's the empty tree, that's not interesting. We just look at the case where it's a non-empty tree. So case T equals some node L and R. I'm looking at the wrong one, I'm sorry. I wanted to look at that one. I think this one will be analogous, but since I have the text in front of me for this one, I will look at that one. So where does that come from? Here we have sum of two logarithms. Okay, let's look at it. So we have T del min of this T up here. By definition, that's the same as T merge. What does del min do? Del min, if you have such a tree, it simply merges the left and the right subtree, so the time for del min is the same as the time for merge, because we're just counting merges. T merge of L and R. And we know up here that's logarithmic in the sum of the sizes. So this is bounded by LG of L1 plus log of R1, and that's it. And plus one, sorry, there's a plus one here. But what we really wanted was this one. We want a T here, because this is just one case where it really consists of a node LR. So how do we get to the T? And my claim is that this is indeed less than 2 times the binary logarithm of size of L plus size of R. And I guess another, that's it, yep. And this, of course, is just the number of leaves in the tree T. And that's exactly what we claimed up here. Oh, there's a plus one, I dropped the plus one. So there's a plus one in both cases. Plus one, plus one. So that works out nicely, except where does this come from?
that the sum of the logarithms is less than equal
2 times the logarithm of the sum.
And I think I'm being a bit confused why we have the plus 1 is getting in the way here.
Okay, you can tell me what went wrong, but let me just
I will now prove that this term is really strictly less than this term without the plus 1. I don't know what happened to the plus 1, because there should be a plus 1 here at the end. Of course, if you add, maybe this plus 1 is superfluous, I'm not quite sure now. So let's focus on this logarithm law, this one less than equal, less than this one, and that's a general law. So it needs a little lemma. If you have logarithm of x plus logarithm of y plus 1, then this is less than 2 times the logarithm of x plus y, if x and y are greater than 0. How does one prove this? Well, if you have inequalities between logarithms, it's usually a good trick and get rid of the logarithms by raising both sides to a power. So let's do that. Let's look at 2 to the log x plus log y plus 1. What's that? That's, of course, x 2 times x times y. So the plus 1 is the 2 times, and the 2 to the logarithms are the multiplication of the x and y. And this, on the other hand, if you take the exponentiation here, 2 to the 2 times log of x plus y, what does that do? Well, this is a squaring, and this 2 to the logarithm of xy, so it's x plus y squared. And I don't think I need quite as much space between the two. This is, of course, the x plus y squared contains the 2 x plus y, but it also contains x squared and y squared, and because x and y are both greater than 0, this is really strictly greater than, because this is really x squared plus y squared plus 2xy. And so that proves the less than relationship here, because you have the if and only if 2 to the a less than 2 to the b, if and only if a less than b. Okay, but that still doesn't explain why what happened to the plus 1, because we got rid of the plus 1 here. On the slide, on the other hand, it's still there. So I'll have to see whether maybe one could even get rid of the plus 1 here. That may have just been an overestimate on my part. On the other hand, I think I know why the plus 1 is there. I think it must be hidden in the other case. If the T is the empty tree, so if it's the empty tree, then the time for delmin, I think, will be 0. I think it should also work out. No, so I'm not quite sure what happened to the plus 1. Did you discover a problem, or?
I'm quite sure, because you proved logarithm of size of L plus logarithm plus size of R plus 1 is strictly smaller than 2 times the logarithm of x plus y. That's the lemma.
is
the supplement
approved? This is the lemma, and I thought I was using it exactly.
What we wanted to prove in the colliery was that t delta of t is smaller or equal than 2 times logarithm 2 of the size of the tree plus 1. Do we really need the strictly smaller one? So if we have plus 1 to the left side, we can say it's
not
equal, and that's...
It's hidden in the less than equal. Yes, of course, if it's less than it's less or equal.
If you add 1, you have...
No, isn't it the other way around? It's the other way around. If it's we've proved less than here on the board at least, and so that in so it should be even. See, if we prove a less than relationship, then it should be less or equal minus 1 on the other side, on the right hand side. At least I think so. So I don't think that's the answer, but let's not spend more time on this. I'll go and check it up. The principle should have become clear what's going on here, and in computer science we never care about one errors off by one errors. But this, I think this must be correct because I've really printed out the text of the lemma. So either this is just too generous, or there's some little mistake in here that I didn't spot. Yes, so of course this has the drawback that you have to store the rank information every node. Can we do better than that? And here's an alternative implementation via something called Brown trees. And the idea of a Brown tree, so you can find the whole text in the Archive of Formal Proofs. And Brown trees can be used for a number of things, and they were originally actually invented by colleagues of Edsger Dijkstra, because Dijkstra, in his little programming language that he used as the basis for writing his algorithms, he had arrays, and he had extensible arrays that you could add elements to at both ends. And they wondered, can we give an efficient implementation to those, the colleagues wondered, can we efficiently implement them if the arrays are really represented as trees? And this is what came out of that. The student was called Brown, and who came up with that idea, and they are called Brown trees because of that. So what is a Brown tree? This is the specification. It says, if you have a node, then the size of the right subtree must be less or equal to the size of the left subtree. So, and the size of the left subtree must be less or equal to the size of the right subtree plus 1. I personally find that always a bit confusing. I prefer this version of saying it, that the left subtree either is the same size as the right subtree or one bigger. This is equivalent to this statement here. Because if the left subtree is smaller than R, well, that can't be. Here we know that it must be at least as big as R. And can it be too bigger than R? No, it can't be. R plus 1 is an upper bound. So really, at least for the left subtree, it can only be equal or 1 larger in terms of the number of elements than the right subtree. So they're almost the same size. But it's always the left one that could be a little bit bigger. And the two subtrees are Brown trees. So this, this is a Brown tree. But I had this wonderful anecdote about Dijkstra, coincidentally, although it's completely unrelated. He lectured at a summer school, and he was lecturing about graph theory, and or graph algorithms. I'm not sure which. I wasn't there, so it's, I heard it from somebody else. And Dijkstra didn't like pictures, so he didn't draw pictures. He just drew formulae. And I don't like pictures because it takes a lot of time to produce them in LaTeX. Otherwise, I do like them. So he never produced any pictures and lectures about graphs, just with formulae. And then after the first lecture, somebody came up to him and asked, well, graphs, I mean, they're very graphical data structure. Would you mind drawing some pictures? And so the next lecture starts. He puts on an empty slide and he says, this is the empty graph. And then he continues. I don't know whether this is true, but I think it is. The person is reliable. So this is the empty brown tree. And here is the one-element brown tree. Here is the two-element brown tree. Here is the three-element brown tree. So you can see what's happening. You always add first on the left. So where's the next one going to go? You can't put it here because that would make this part very unbalanced with respect to this part, so it has to go here. And then you fill them up. Can you fill them up first here? No, because then this would be bigger than this subtree, so you first fill it up there, and it's just one bigger and then there. So it's very close to a balanced tree. You never have more than a difference of height and minimal height of more than one, and you have a very specific pattern. And it, of course, it would continue down here as well. The next brown tree would be that one, and then after the four, here to the five, then I think six, then seven, and then the other sides, four, and there, and so, yeah, something like that. So that you can see, as balanced trees, they are as balanced as it gets. This is the formula. And this is, right, this is just the idea of maintaining the invariant. This is just reproduction of the invariant under insertion and deletion of elements. And how do we add an element to a brown tree? And now we're thinking of the brown tree already as a priority queue, as a heap, because we allow ourselves to swap left and right subtrees. So we add the element to the right subtree, and then we swap the subtrees. Why does that work? Because what can happen, L can be equal to R before you do that, you add an element, you've added it to the right subtree, now the right subtree became bigger, but you swap them, and then you have again the bigger one on the left. Or L can be equal to R plus 1. you add it to the right subtree, so now they have the same size, then you swap them and they again have the same size. So this is the argument that I just gave you, but a bit more in a more precise fashion. So this is what we start with, and then we add an element to the right subtree. So and then we swap them. So this is the condition that we will have to satisfy afterwards, because the what is the new R? It's the old L. What is the new L? It's the old R plus 1, same here. And then here you have R plus 1, but it's the new R is the old L. So this is the formula for the chained subtree after you've added an element and swapped the subtrees. And why is this formula true? This part here, L is less or equal R plus 1, that comes from this formula. And this part here, you just subtract 1, and then it comes from this assumption. So you can really see that the invariant is maintained if you do this swapping. You add it to the smaller subtrees, and then you swap. And deletion is the opposite. You delete from the bigger subtree, and then you swap. And again, it will retain the invariant. It's just the dual process. Okay, so this is the idea of a Brown tree and deleting and adding elements to it, and that preserves the Brown tree invariant. And now we really make it into a priority queue. So the implementation is just a tree. The invariants are both the old heap invariant and now no longer the leftist tree because it's just an ordinary binary tree, the Brown tree invariant. And we don't have a merge function here. I'm not sure if there should exist a simple merge function. I've never seen one, and I think it could be difficult. So we just define insert and del min explicitly on the Brown trees. So how does insert work?
Let's see which one I wanted to discuss on the board and which one I really wanted to show. Okay.
Oops, that was a bit too much. This is it. Insert is quite easy. Inserting into the empty Brown tree creates a singleton Brown tree. Inserting into an existing Brown tree, if the A that you want to insert is the smallest element, then you have to move it to the top. Then you put the left subtree there and you insert X into the right subtree. So this was precisely what we had on the previous slide, inserting an element into Brown tree. How do you do it? You insert it into the right, into the smaller subtree, but you swap. So this is what you have. You inserted the X into the possibly smaller subtree R. They can also be of the same size. And then you swap the L and the R. And similarly here, where if X is the smaller element, you put X at the top and you insert the A into the right and you have the left, turn the left into the right. Yeah. Del min, let's look at that one. So if there's nothing in there's nothing to delete. If there's just one element in there, the X, then you delete that and you return the empty tree. By the way, what happened to the right subtree? Why could we throw the right subtree away? Yeah. Yeah. So this just saved us a little bit of execution time because our pattern matching will now doesn't have to check that this is empty as well. It'll be empty by the invariant. And if it's really both are non-empty, if L is non-empty and therefore R could still be empty. Yeah, but L is non-empty, that's the main part. Then you delete the leftmost element from L, or rather this should be called split leftmost element, except that that's a long name. And so this is the leftmost element, and this is the remainder. So you have something like this. And here you have your X, and here you have the leftmost element. There's your Y hanging off somewhere on the left. And now what you do is you create a subtree without the Y. Well, I can't draw that very well. So you remove the Y from that whole tree here. You're left over with some L prime. And then you have to, so this would be L. Let me try and draw this a little bit better. So this is the situation, and you
remove the y, and you are left with the L prime. And then the y has to find its proper place. So you now call a function sift down of L prime, y, and r. Or rather, we have already swapped the two. I'm not quite sure whether that is really relevant. I don't think so. I think that should be the order of the r and the y prime should be irrelevant. but you've taken some element out of here, and then you have inserted it to its right place. This is really not this minimal element or anything. It's in fact, it's one of the largest elements because it's down at the very bottom, but there could be other large elements at, somewhere else down here. So you just have to find its proper place now in that combined heap. And so all the work is done by the function sift down. The function delmin itself hardly does anything. It just it deletes that x, it throws it away, and in some sense replaces it by the y, but then it has to find the proper place for the y, because the y will not be the minimum element, it will be some large element. And so all the work is in the delmin function. Is the sift down function. And it's really quite reminiscent of heap sort, except that it's not done on an array, so you're not doing any index computations to find the parents or the of a node or the children, but you're doing it on a tree structure without any indices. The left, I don't think we need to go through that one. That's the usual. So sift down is the most interesting one. And if you have two empty trees, well, then you just create the singleton tree from it. And if you have on the left a singleton tree, on the right the empty tree, so here we are actually assuming that this is the bigger tree and this is the smaller tree. Is that correct? What did we call R and L prime? Yes, because L prime is the result of removing an element, and so it could be smaller than R, and so this call here for sift down makes sure that R is at least as big as L. So here in the second base case, this one could be I'm not quite sure why this couldn't be a singleton as well. So what's going on? What's happening? So you move A to the top. I mean, it stays at the top here. And you just make them into trees. And otherwise, you swap A and X if X is the bigger one. I guess we now have the last case where both arguments are non-empty trees. And so that's why we didn't need to take care of a singleton tree here, because it'll be part of the general case. So, sift down of L1, X1, R1, and let's call this one T1, and similarly, L2, X2, R2. Oh, sorry, something in the middle, of course, as well. A, R2. And let's call this one T2. First case distinction, maybe A is the minimal element. Then we're lucky. So if A is less or equal to X1 and A is less or equal to X2, what do we do? We just create a heap which really has A in the middle and T1 and T2 on either side. At least that's, I think, what we should be doing. Yes.
So if A is not the smallest element of the three, A and X1 and X2, then it must be either X1 or X2 that must be the smallest elements. So let's look at the case if X1 is less or equal to X2. What do we do then? Any suggestions? Well, it's pretty clear that since A is not the minimal element and X1 is less than X2, it must be X1. So surely X1 should go into the middle.
Yeah.
Then we can probably sit down on the left side the A. So sit down L1, A, R1.
Sit down, what?
Right.
I said, what were the arguments?
It should be L1, A, R1.
Yep, I think that's right. And then here is just T2. Yes, I think that's that.
So yes, sift down L1 AR1, X1 and T2.
So here we don't do any argument swapping because the argument swapping has already happened at the very top when we did the here. In the sift down, we have already swapped the R and the L, and we are now perfectly okay in inserting the element Y in the right place. We don't need to do any other size-based swapping. And here it's just the second one, the sift down. If X2 is this minimal one, then X2 goes in the middle, T1 is unchanged, and we sift down the A into L2 and R2. And it maintains the Brown invariant according to the argument we gave earlier. The functional correctness proof isn't challenging. There are quite a number of lemmas, but they're all very easy. So now, why do we have a logarithmic complexity? Because the running time of all these three functions, insert, del left, and sift down, and therefore del min, are bounded by the height. They all go down the tree by the height. And we have this, I flashed this up very briefly earlier, where the height is logarithmic in the size of the tree. So we have a logarithmic bound by the height, by the size of the tree in all the functions. Yeah. And the code is originally due to Larry Paulson, but I think it's really due to Chris Okazaki, because Larry writes in his book, thanks Chris for the code. And I think I mentioned I definitely mentioned Chris Okazaki on the web page, and he wrote this very influential book, Functional Data Structures, or Purely Functional Data Structures, and that was the outcome of his PhD thesis, and where he was the first person to really systematically collect and study many functional data structures, which were previously, people were always thinking in terms of imperative implementations, but he showed that you could also implement them efficiently in functional languages. Now, I mentioned heap sort, and indeed you can sort quite easily with priority queues. So first you can turn a list into a priority queue. That could be, so this was the end of the Brown tree part. First you can turn a priority queue in, so first you can turn a list into a priority queue, so the empty list becomes the empty priority queue, and if you have a cons, then you insert the element in the priority queue of the rest, and then you can extract the minimal elements one by one. So means of queue, if the priority queue is empty, then it's the empty set, and otherwise you get the minimal element of what is this H? I think that should be an H here as well, otherwise it doesn't make sense. And then you take the minimum elements that are left over when you delete the minimum from the priority queue, and so you have a sort via a priority queue by first creating a priority queue and then extracting all the minimal elements one by one. And that has complexity of sort PQ, that should say, this slide is not very good, is O of n log n, assuming that the priority queue functions all have logarithmic or better complexity. And I think I don't want to go into the binomial heaps today. I will, instead, I think what I'll do is I will, since we do have a moment, I will go into the Isabel and see what went wrong, or what that thing up there, the complexity for Delmin, where I thought it should be something else, but...